Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Hans Lemerson.
But didn't you know that all yields are equal in value? Plus one gold is the same as plus one production.
Oh my gosh. We're going to that strategy and tips thread now.
Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast about civilization and all things about civilization that we can think of and talk about. Today, we'll be talking about things which were published on the internet, things which I'm reading right now, things like the new DLC, things like civilizations. Did you know that the game Civilization has different civilizations in it? It's true, and they're not all the same. Some are different. Did you know that Civilization can even be an e-sport? I didn't, but now I do. This podcast is educational. Episode number 281. I'm the guest, Hans Lemerson, and joining me is the Polycast team, Makalua, the Mian team, Mad Jin, and Dan Q.
I just like the idea that I have now been granted a license to talk about all things related to Civ that I can think of as part of this intro. This is like, I've been granted an amazing new power on Polycast.
No. You see, we treat guests better than the actual regular hosts. It's a very Canadian, Canadian thing to do.
I've got a corner. I'm just going to keep pulling on it.
But with great power comes great...
conquest. With great power comes great conquest.
Yeah. I think that's about right.
K popped out last week and went, boo, everybody! The Civ 6 Digital Deluxe Edition that you paid for a while ago, but may or may not have gotten good savings. Well, guess what? Here's two more DLC for you. Woohoo! Anybody who bought the Civ 6 Digital Deluxe Edition at release will automatically get the next two DLC, making it even better. And in theory, they are going to have civs from Africa and Southeast Asia. In theory, it's also three new leaders, but only two additional civilizations. So, take your pick. And of course, some scenario packs.
I think they're obviously going to add another leader for Congo. That would be the most sensible choice.
Totally. In the realm of speculation, obviously one civ should be Southeast Asia and one civ should be Africa. Though they could easily pull one leader from Africa and two civs from Southeast Asia, and I don't think anybody would complain much.
How many Southeast Asian civs are there right now?
They don't count as India or China. Just in case you misunderstood geography, India and China are not Southeast Asia.
But I thought Indochina was both of them at the same time.
Totally.
No.
Overall, the reception to it is good. People have been awaiting the trolls to come by and say, this was bad to do, but no one ever did. Really.
This was bad.
How dare you give us more free stuff?
Yeah. No. Actually, people should be indignant that everything wasn't perfect, exactly perfect the first time. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the way to go. When you have nothing else, you fall back on that one.
In response to the official Facebook post by 2K, there were some people saying, hey, can you fix the game before you add more stuff?
Oh,
I would appreciate that, but they're not going to do it, so.
No, they'll just add more stuff while fixing the game.
Yeah,
exactly.
For Southeast Asia, I think some of the higher competitors are, at least on the forums, Khmer, Siam, Burma, Vietnam. Basically, if it's a country that has ever been in Southeast Asia, given that it's such a tiny spot.
It's a possibility.
Depending on where you fully box in Southeast Asia, if you include the islands or not, depending. Indonesia is an obvious one. It's been in before. For the African side, Carthage is getting a lot of love and attention. Although some people believe that.
But.
Yeah, it is Africa.
It is.
It is technically in Africa, but isn't it a little more culturally closer to European, though, you know?
No. Oh,
come on. None of this co-opting stuff, Mackie.
They were Phoenicians.
Yes, they were Phoenicians.
Yeah.
Which is not Europe.
It's 11 teams.
Yeah, okay, but it's also not exactly Africa either.
Well, Carthage is in Africa.
Whether you agree with that or not, Morocco isn't in Africa. I mean, like, from a perspective, Egypt.
There was somebody who actually claimed Egypt was an African. Have you looked at the map lately?
Egypt is not African.
They have too much land on another continent. They don't count. Depending on the year, Great Britain can be European or Indian. See, it's the second Indian civ. There are two after all.
Yep. Boom, ba boom, boom, boom. There's your alt leader. People have kind of said not Zulu, saying that, no, they'll keep Zulu for an expansion or something like that.
Quite possible.
Yeah, I'd be okay not seeing Zulu again. Shaka just needs a spiritual successor. It doesn't have to be Shaka.
There's discussion about Mali, Ghana, or the Songhai probably getting all merged into one and then just give them two leaders.
How does that work?
Well, they're all basically spiritual successors of each other-ish.
I guess, although Mali and Songhai existed concurrently, and Ghana is a little different from the majority of the existence of either.
Look, they're all on roughly the same river network and geographical area, and they all conquered each other. It's like we should just have a European civilization, you know?
I mean, granted, it's not as egregious as the Native American civilization led by Sitting Bull. That was, but I mean, come on.
It's still kind of what?
Yeah. So some people are just throwing that out there. Obviously, Ethiopia keeps getting thrown around because, Ethiopia.
Yeah. Zimbabwe.
The trollish South Africa. Then Nubia, because, you know, might as well throw Nubia in there.
I think Nubia is too close to Egypt, which we've established isn't African, so I don't know if we can use them.
Well, I mean, Nubia was at least more sub-Sahara Africa than Egypt was, culturally and racially.
Yeah. I guess more so? Question mark?
Besides the conversation about what civilizations are going to be included, and then, of course, subsequently, what leaders within. From the official Facebook page, someone asked, will this content be available as downloadable content to everyone else? As in, those people who don't have the digital deluxe edition? I just kind of laughed at that. And the official response was, yes, this content will be made available separately, just as previous DLC packs in. And someone else also asked, is the 25th anniversary edition included? Although they did put a winky face in there, and it's like, yes, seeing as though the anniversary edition includes the digital deluxe, you're covered, quote unquote. And then someone also asked on Facebook, is there to come an upgrade to deluxe edition feature on Steam anytime soon? To which, not specifically that post, but another post that asked the exact same question, the response from Sid Meier's Civilization, which is publisher 2K, no, because Steam doesn't have that capability.
That sounds a little odd because I've seen plenty of other games that let you do upgrade editions.
Some people sell it separately, even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that was the official response, and I raised an eyebrow at that.
Yeah, I'd say, what the hell do they think they're talking about?
You know what they did? They passed the buck to Steam on that when it's not a Steam. I had to make that pun, obviously.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I know, right? It helps that you pointed it out indirectly. I appreciate that, Hans. Thanks. That makes the pun all the better. Someone on Steam said, goes by the handle Sabina, so owners of the original Civ 6 will get nothing. We'll still have to buy the DLC or the deluxe edition. This is almost a non-announcement.
You only bought the base edition. Of course you're not getting extra. Available for you to buy like anybody else. Like, we would have had to buy if they hadn't decided to include it as deluxe.
Yeah, as was included in the announcement, quote, we saw that prices with certain currencies didn't live up to the savings we're looking to deliver, and so we are excited to offer this new content at no additional charge to those who purchase or already own the Civilization VI Digital Deluxe Edition, unquote. So, I think it's pretty clear. Elsewise, on Civilization Fanatic Center, Winged Nose Ring, says, first off, great move by Firaxis. The Digital Deluxe Edition had a lot of people riled and generated a lot of bad community feedback and lousy Steam reviews. This news was entirely unexpected and appreciated, even by non-deluxe digital owners like myself. Which led some people to say, so can people go and change their negative Steam ratings on the Vikings DLC? Well, people are not going to do that, number one. And quite frankly, the fact that something comes after the Vikings DLC is not, to me, about the Vikings DLC, except a lot of the negative reviews about the Vikings DLC is less about the content of what is included as opposed to what's not included. But Morningcom adds, the best solution to the DLC pricing controversy under the circumstances, in my opinion, at least Firaxis listens. It's a positive step forward, though I still think DLC for a game like Civ is somewhat manipulative. Oh, well, yes, that debate is never going to go away. Although Shaglio did ask, what people expect has no bearing on what Firaxis plans. That I say there is in fact evidence to the contrary, at least from claims by 2K and Firaxis, which was, well, you know, we included the Congo because it was the most requested Civ at the end of Civilization V's development cycle. And it's like, well, I don't know, we still don't know how you measured that. But still, if people expect something and they don't communicate that, then yes, that would have no bearing on Firaxis' plans because they can't read your mind. Yet, but I'm sure they're working on that technology. But if you share that information and like-minded people chime in, then yes, they are going to pay attention. Now, Firaxis listens, as Morningcom says. That doesn't mean they're always going to act, or they're going to act in the way that we want to. But in this case, let's just give a mini round of applause for something good is happening. Yay! We'll have plenty to complain about in the future still. Don't worry about that.
I think the lesson we can learn from this is that it's easier to balance money than gameplay.
So this is our next as and against profile on civilizations in Civilization VI.
We have China. Civility. Eureka's and inspirations provide 60% technologies instead of 50%. It's decent. It's pretty good. Unique unit blows, but it's pretty threatening, so I don't know. It's one of those units that, like, I don't like.
Hang on. It's threatening, but it blows.
It blows.
Make it fine.
Here's my line of thinking for this. It's annoying to fight them because they are significantly better against what you would usually use to counter archers, but their one range really, really deflates the excitement for using them. They are strong, I guess. They're not awful, but man, I hate one range units.
It really needs to be a situation where, oh, guess what? I got to this era before you, and you don't have any comparable units that can do damage to my unique unit, so get wrecked. Too bad for your one range. Go ahead, scratch the paint.
It'll resist enemy ranged fire. It can kill earlier era units pretty easily, although it'll still take some work to bring down a knight, and knights can still hurt them pretty badly. So, yeah, like you said, if you're not an era in front, then this gets pretty average pretty quickly. They're terrible at taking cities, because you know, you're not battering ram meleeing the city. You're not a siege unit, so yeah, I don't know. It's there. I guess if you're defending yourself, like, out of desperation or something, it's a little better. But I feel like the way the game works with melee and range units, and how range units have actual range and can shoot or attack from areas that melee units can't, that is the draw of a ranged unit, and this loses that draw significantly. So I'm not too happy with the Crouching Tiger. I think it's one of the weaker things China gets. But they're still annoying to fight because the AI sucks at using its range units. And so this is more along the AI's lines of going to actually be able to shoot at you after you wail on it.
Well, and speaking of defending yourself out of desperation, if you're China.
Yes. You're going to segue it for me. So we got the Great Wall, which is an interesting implementation of it. It's no longer as readily getting danned.
No, there is no danning from the Great Wall in Civ 6.
And nor can you completely ignore barbarian units, which is sorely missed in this game for a number of reasons. But no, what it does is it gives you 4 defense if you're standing on it with a military unit. It does not make your builders resist enemy attacks very effectively. +1 gold for adjacent segments, masonry. And +1 culture and tourism for adjacent segments with castles.
I kind of view this similar to the Sphinx. It's like, okay, I got to use a builder charge for it. Fine, my builders get 4 charges instead of 3 as China, but still, I got to use a builder charge for it, and I can't put something else on this hex.
Yes, but you see, you're missing some synergy here. Since China can use their builders to rush ancient and classical wonders, and ancient and classical wonders such as the pyramids and especially Petra. And Petra, so you work the hills and then the desert tiles, which you can't improve with hardly anything else, you just fill with great walls. So you have one really good city.
I would rather fill those tiles, say, perhaps with an entertainment district.
What?
As I'm conquering to be able to keep my empire happy when I'm stressed for amenities.
Conquering with a crouching tiger? I think not.
this is also a little bit underrated for just a poor man's fort. You get it at Masonry, which is pretty early in the game. You can build it with a builder. So again, you can get that really fast, especially the AI, but really anybody that's attacking you in somewhat choke-like terrain, +4 from the Great Wall on something like a hill defense can add up pretty quickly. And it gets to the point where contemporary units really struggle to do much damage. They need to use a lot of resources to dislodge that. And if they don't, then they have to deal with zone of control. So that's something you can consider, especially if you're looking at somebody's power spiking and you're like, well, okay, I'm probably going to get attacked. It might be worth one builder charge just for that.
I can certainly see particular hexes where it could be advantageous, you know, like on a choke point within your territory. But to all of a sudden have this really long extended great wall across your empire, not so much.
Well, yeah, that's just to rub it in on someone if you're running away with the game and build a huge wall.
So really, this is the small fortification of China.
Yeah, it's available early. It's a great help. And yes, you did mention the leader bonus earlier, Ancient Classical Wonders. You may spend builder charges to complete 15% of the original wonder cost. So you can focus fire wonder construction with an extra builder charge on top of that. So you can build wonders pretty quickly and reliably with China.
That is decent.
Build the pyramids. That's all you do. Build pyramids.
By and large, I feel like the Eureka's thing is solid. That'll help you pretty much every game, especially if you're utilizing that effectively. It's the closest thing we have to a science sieve right now. You can focus down a good early wonder or two, but this is like a middle-of-the-pack sieve in my mind because the Crouching Tiger holds it back. It's like playing without a unique unit in a lot of ways.
You know, in Civilization VI, China and their abilities are kind of like Neapolitan ice cream. There's the vanilla flavor, you know, it's just kind of the middle of the road. And then you got the chocolate, like, which is really, really good. And then the strawberry, which is just kind of...
Yeah, if you get that on ice cream, you're wrong. You should have gotten chocolate. Anyway, QSH dislikes people who build more wonders than him. Pretty straightforward. Which means that he is a decently likely ally when you're playing the game conquering stuff. Because you're not building wonders. And therefore, he doesn't mind you very much at first. And then when half the world has had its blood spilled, he doesn't like you, but he's next, so it's fine.
Egypt. Leader bonus is Mediterranean's Bride, which her trade routes that go to other civilizations give +4 gold to Egypt. Yeah, but other civilizations' trade routes going to Egypt give +2 food for them and +2 gold for Egypt. So if you're trading with her, you're just giving her stuff and more stuff and more stuff. Stop giving her stuff so she can build her chariot archers.
I guess, but by my estimation, this is a relatively weak sieve. I mean, you can use it, and it's probably better than Spain, but I don't know. Like, her ability helps, but it's not amazing. The Chariot Archer is awkward. That has a very short window on higher difficulties. Maybe it's better in a multiplayer. I would say it is measurably better than the Archer and a little bit easier to use offensively. So you have some play with a unique unit, not very big on the Sphinx. And the trade route bonus just sucks, man. Like, most of the time, you should be using internal trade routes, with some exceptions. Something that's only relevant a small percentage of the time, and a lot less relevant by even more in if you're fighting other people, because they'll just kill your trade routes. This strikes me as pretty weak, for the most part.
Yes, the Sphinx, it can be built on any land terrain, cannot be adjacent to another Sphinx. You're going to get +1 culture, +1 appeal, +1 faith, and then an additional 2 faith if placed next to a wonder. See, it's less about the Sphinx itself, although that certainly is an issue, and more about, you know, I could construct a farm here, for example, or I could put a mine here, and I'm going to be that much farther ahead. So I guess I might put a Sphinx on, say, a desert hex, which, if you're Egypt, you're probably going to have some of those.
It's still a builder charge, though.
It is also still a builder charge, yes. Yes, so it should not be your first priority.
I guess if you're going heavy into, like, faith rush buying, or you're going into a culture attempt or something, you can make a case for building this on hexes that you wouldn't otherwise use in the mid to late game. Its opportunity cost is a lot less. It's actually providing yields for something that's not working it directly. Okay, but it's pretty weak.
Yeah, you got to get high enough pop to be able to work the hexes in the first place, which means not probably constructing these first. Unless your terrain is really bad. And then you probably just want to be exploring the map and finding somewhere else to settle that.
If your terrain is bad, you're building that chariot archer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Districts and wonders are built 15% faster if they're placed next to the river, and floodplains don't block placement of districts and wonders. Although, why would you want to place stuff on the floodplains when you can get food?
Yeah.
If you take the Pantheon for it, you can get hammers, and that's a pretty good Pantheon, one of the better ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you're desperate or there happens to be like an amazing position
for district. Super amazing start where it's just like, yeah, that too.
Yeah.
So you get like a lot of adjacency bonus. Okay.
But in my first game, I started in the middle of the swamp. I was like, oh man, what am I going to do here? There's no production. And then I founded my pantheon.
Yeah.
And it was good.
That 15% bonus with the districts or wonders if they're adjacent to a river, that's nice too. Particularly with wonders. That might be the difference between you getting it before the AI.
Yeah. For the wonders, yeah, I can see it. But 15% seems kind of weak.
Yeah. Especially in the early game where you just don't have that many hammers to toss around. It's something, but again, it's not a strong bonus, like getting a free monument in every city or something.
Oh yeah, like Rome, yeah. No.
Yeah, like Rome.
Well, I feel like the district part of that being built 15% faster, a place adjacent to river, its value is currently exaggerated because of district cost scaling.
The real restriction on districts is, I mean, aside from the production cost, population. If you can't grow your city, you can't get more districts. So,
and if you start building stuff over those nice floodplains, you're really not going to grow as fast.
Yeah.
But hopefully you can find something that's next to a river that is not a floodplain, and so then you can place a district on it and get a boost, like, say, your commercial hub. Which would probably get you an adjacency bonus anyway for being on river.
Yeah, that +2 gold is essential for the success and utility of commercial hub.
Yeah, you might as well take it, especially considering, I mean, as Egypt's starting, you're probably not going to be around any mountains as likely, which is kind of too bad with respect to the Sphinx and, you know, for holy sites and stuff like that. But it's also particularly kind of sad face with regards to your campuses. So perhaps you want to take that adjacency bonus for the commercial hub on the river, which you're going to be able to construct the commercial hub more quickly, and if you find other civilizations and you're trying to compensate for perhaps lack of production, then maybe you can be buying, say, your campus buildings while you continue to push your commerce through your commercial hub and your trade routes.
Just takes up with chariots, then you have mountains. Although these chariots are not nearly on the level of the earlier civs chariots for Egypt.
No.
That's mostly because those are amazing units.
Civ 4 war chariots.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Given that the Chariot Archer does not require horses, and it's going to gain +2 movement points if you start on flat terrain, which is probably what you're going to be experiencing as Edith, they can be very good for early barb duty coming into your lands, or otherwise people trying to take your stuff early on. They can be good defense.
You take incendiary promotions on them, they you can take someone out pretty reliably. I mean, you can take someone out on deity with archers pretty reliably, so this is a step up in a number of ways. The only problem is you can't really pre-build them, so that's a limitation. You probably would still want to make a couple normal archers or build up a melee unit or two first, but they're still good.
Why is pre-building a thing?
Because the hammer to gold ratio that you get on upgrades is so much cheaper than purchasing a unit that it's stupid. And yeah. I think that's a balanced problem in this game, but it is what it is.
She likes it when you have a strong army, but if you have a weak one, she hates you. We've all seen this in action in very many games, multiplayer. Oh, look, she hates me. Oh, look, she likes me.
She loves me. She loves me not. I could just see her pulling the petals off the flower right now.
I gave you the TLDR. Just beat on her and she'll like you.
Yep. Gotta convince her your army is strong.
Well, it also reduces the strength of her army, making the relative strength of your army to hers higher.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny when she decides that she doesn't like you because of the size of her army when she's down to one city and there's other AI on the map and stuff. And you're like, okay, whatever, girl.
No, that's fine. No, please go ahead and denounce me. So then I've got a cash's belly against you and I take less war weariness. That's excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Oi. So what about playing against Egypt? Because we talk about playing as and interacting with. What about playing against Egypt? You know, I'm not feeling particularly threatened by Egypt just based on their abilities themselves, which I guess really isn't a surprise given everything else that we've said at this point.
I would not want to deal with a person controlling the chariot archers in the early game, though. Especially if the terrain around my capital is flat, so they can, like, pillage and run in and kill units or threaten workers or whatever with relatively few of them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you want to distinguish between single player and multiplayer right now? Yeah, fair enough. Okay, sure.
Yeah, but in single player, it's a joke, because the AI doesn't know what it's doing with its units. And those things, as strong as they are in ranged attack, are not great in melee, so it's okay.
So step one is advance to the spearmen and then end your turn.
If they get going on a rush of wonders.
But then you get wonders when you take them and you have high score. Yeah. You can make Dan shed tears because he doesn't have high score because you took the wonders.
And when you invest heavily in wonders, you're not investing in military. You are giving wonders to your neighbor.
Yeah, but I guess if you like have a player who just lets her build all those and then doesn't punish it, I guess.
quite honestly, like, if Egypt is still around in the mid to late game, maybe they should get a Perseverance Award. Next in our As and Against Civilization 6 profiles,
we have England. England, with the ability to be slightly better at Navy than other civilizations in certain ways. The leader bonus for Victoria, Pax Britannica. All found and conquered cities on a continent other than your home continent receive a free melee unit. Gain the Redcoat unique unit when military science technology is researched. Okay, so they get a unique unit along with their cavalry, so that's helpful, maybe. And they get it if they found cities or conquer cities on other continents. I guess if you're doing a world conquest, it's a little helpful. But
that can snowball, because you can start stacking them into armies, or cores, then armies. And even though the unit you generate isn't promoted, if you stick it with another unit and fuse, then you you keep the promotions from your better unit. It's a lot of production. And the way this game tracks continents, if you're doing heavy conquest in the game, a majority of your cities that you're taking will be receiving this bonus. So this can snowball pretty quickly.
Yeah, and speaking of snowball, if you're at military science and you can get redcoats, I mean, all found and conquered cities on a continent, other than your own home continent, receive a free melee unit. Maybe your free melee unit is a redcoat, which has additional combat strength when fighting on a continent other than your own.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you get those. You get plus 10 strength in addition to the core strength or army strength. You can get these to a level where, with a battering ram, LOL, you're smashing through cities like nothing.
They require no resources and there's no cost to disembark.
Yeah, it's pretty solid, especially on some maps.
Can you deliberately get rid of your capital so that all cities are on continents different from your capital?
No, because if you lose your capital, a game will auto-make one of your other cities your capital. It still tracks your original capital for domination victory purposes to other civs, but you always have a capital.
So you always have a home continent, yep.
I guess if you're really, really good with how the game handles the switch, you could predictively give up your capital to move which continent the game considers you on. But for all practical purposes, you just wipe your continent early and then you go on a tear everywhere else and get this bonus all the time.
Yeah.
The Sea Dog, unique naval raider unit, which you can use to escort your redcoats.
They're only 5 strength weaker than infantry by default, and then they're getting plus 10 from being on foreign continent. If you have cores and you're going up against a naked tank, and if you, of course, in promotions and a great general, you can easily trash tanks and infantry with redcoats.
Wait, so if you stack bonuses, you can defeat your enemy?
Future eras, though, which is pretty helpful. Because normally, like, you can stack bonuses until you're blue in the face, but swords are still pretty bad against, like, knights.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's like your unique unit is making it so that if you do put your bonuses together, you can actually beat knights straight up with a sword. And that's pretty significant, considering you're getting those redcoats as freebies every time you take a city.
The leader agenda, The Sun Never Sets, wants to expand to all continents on the map. What? Like Civ, who shares her home continent and dislikes Civs on continents without her cities.
Well, this explains why England, when we've played Islands and F, loves to put little tiny crap cities everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little tiny crap cities can have harbors, and harbors can have trade routes, and trade routes can be wasted on sending to city-states.
Yeah?
No, they can be wasted by sending them to Egypt.
Oh, that's true.
They're buying extra food.
And those Sea Dogs can be built in a certain unique district for England.
Yeah, which they no longer get for free.
From a population slot perspective, that is.
Yes. Now, England's not the only one.
Necessary nerf.
Yes, it was necessary. Still doesn't take away from the Royal Navy Dockyard itself.
The Royal Navy Dockyard is the closest thing we have to a discounted commercial hub, which would be OP.
Well, no, the discount for your commercial hubs or just your commerce in general is being able to trade with commercial city-states, but that's a whole other separate thing. what does the Royal Navy Dockyard give us that we don't get with the harbor?
Plus 1 movement for all units built in Dockyard. No, that's good. Plus 2 gold when built on a foreign continent.
Well, I see, and that's why you were talking about all those English cities being built all over the place, so they could construct the Royal Navy Dockyard and get plus 2 gold on top of all the other gold.
Synergy!
Takes a while to set up, though, if you're just making a city with no production.
Well, that goes without saying.
You get your production from trade routes.
Or you've got forests to chop, but maybe some.
On this little crap islands, I and a human player might actually found the city in a competent location, but
a human might. They might.
And plus 1 Great Admiral point per turn?
So it's an improved harbor that costs less, in essence. And so if you are on a map that actually utilizes water, England's even better.
Even more betterer?
Even more betterer.
The British Museum. Each archaeological museum holds 6 artifacts instead of 3, and can support 2 archaeologists at once.
Just wait.
Archaeological museums are automatically themed when they have 6 artifacts.
Okay, now.
What is this crap?
Think it belongs in a museum?
This doesn't have anything to do with conquering other civilizations. Get this crap out of here.
I guess the only way it does is if they have artifacts that you capture and then you've got places to put them, but that seems pretty incidental to wiping other people out.
And why do you have places to put them? You're conquering. I guess if you conquer places to put them, then you can then put the conquered things in there, but it's not going to change very much.
It is possible, as you're going on a conquest spree, to accidentally win a culture victory first.
I've yet to have that happen.
I have had that happen, and it was how I unlocked the culture victory, and I actually said a bad word. No, I don't want this achievement. I don't want this on my record. Dan, going for culture victories now. No, it wasn't on purpose. So, if you're playing against England...
Rush them out early on their own continent.
I'm much more concerned with England being on the map than Egypt. For reasons that are... I wouldn't say they're self-explanatory, but we've kind of covered them. Because they're going to want what it is that you have. Because you're not where they are. And that's where they want to be.
Or you can just start on their home continent and never have to fight a war with them because they like you.
Wipe them out. They're annoying.
If you can't wipe them out, at least for a little while, at least keep them boxed in.
Yeah.
You don't want them going all imperialistic on you. You don't want them to have an imperial empire.
I hate imperial empires.
Like most people who don't run imperial empires. So I feel like if the 3 civilizations that we focused on this episode were all in a game and there were no other viable competitors for their first interactions, what would happen is that China would take over Egypt and then Britain would take over China.
Just like history.
First, Civilization VI Esports Tournament Review. We first discussed Civilization VI becoming an official esport last November in episode 269 from an announcement the month before from Team Liquid Pro. They described themselves as a quote-unquote professional esports organization. They're based in the Netherlands. Civ VI became only the 2nd strategy title in its roster after StarCraft II and, of course, the 1st turn-based strategy game. Other titles include Halo, League of Legends, and Super Smash Bros. Team Liquid has been around since 2001, originally as a news website for StarCraft. Well, on the 24th of February, in update and continuation, Team Liquid is incredibly excited to announce the inaugural Civilization VI Esports Challenge, a 3v3 tournament which will take place, and which did take place, on the 25th and 26th of March, and featured a $1,000 prize pool. That was $500 for first, $250 for second, $150 for third, and $100 for fourth. And yes, that is American dollars, not Canadian dollars, or Australian dollars, or whatever else you might be thinking in terms of dollars. They also said that while we anxiously waited for Firaxis to fix team play, we partnered with 2 modders to design the next best thing. A balanced gameplay. I have to pause here on the quote for a second. Balanced gameplay. Okay, I'll continue to read. Quote, and a mirror map ideal for esports competition. We even designed a spectator mode so we viewers could join in on the action. Unquote. And you might be thinking, wait a minute, how are viewers joining in on the action? I'm actually going to wrap back around to that because that was actually true-ish. We'll come back to the ish. So again, this competition took place on the 25th and the 26th of March. All victory conditions were enabled. Maximum 100 turns. They had a dynamic turn timer.
Mm-hmm.
And the Aztecs, the Romans, the Scythians, and the Sumerians were quote-unquote banned for balance. Now, you may be wondering, why did they have a dynamic turn timer? Well, Mr. Game Theory, his real name is Steven Tarkowski. He's described as the team captain for Civilization VI at Team Liquid Pro. Competitive Civilization community has a root in a turn limit, and a turn limit results in an additional layer of gameplay because the game will be called on score.
That's decent, because it makes otherwise non-viable moves potentially viable, and then it's the other side's job to punish. They're underselling military to gouge score. I think Team Liquid is doing their best. When I heard about the concept of Civ VI as an esport, I kind of balked at it, because the game is nowhere near in a state that would make it competitively viable. But Team Liquid's doing their best here. And you know what? Compared to Firaxis, I have a lot more faith in Team Liquid's capacity to balance. That's not saying I think very highly, but they are much more likely to be capable of it than Firaxis, especially because of their time with StarCraft II.
Well, I was about to say, given the fact, the history, you know, this isn't their first foray into competitive esports, so they can take the lessons learned from other games and more likely to adapt them to a turn-based strategy game as compared to 2K or Firaxis, which has never done anything like this.
In contrast to Firaxis, they've also been involved with a game where that knows what balance actually looks like. Zing! But that's never really been the focus design of Civ. You know, that's not a goal of the typical Civilization strategy game, is to have all the Civs be balanced. It's not even close to the goal. That's like way down the priority list, so that's fair. But on the other hand, it's definitely not balanced or anywhere near, not from a victory condition perspective, not from a Civ perspective, not from really any perspective you could look at, is the Civ series balanced. And that's not unique to Civ 6. That's been true in every Civilization game where after the Civ stopped being completely generic.
Yeah.
The Civ 1 and 2, I mean, okay, that was reasonably balanced aside from start position, but not so much now.
My trailing off on the quote-unquote revelation from Mr. Game Theory that they're going to call the game based on score is more to do with how score is calculated, which is probably part of the reason why they did it, as opposed to why are you using score. But anyway, elsewise from the tournament, starting Warriors and Settlers stack on top of each other. I thought that this was interesting from a competitive perspective. I really hadn't given any consideration to this, and I read it, and I went, oh, okay, that makes sense. Quote, lots of players complained that the east side had an advantage over the west side because starting warriors always spawned on the left side, making it easier for the right side to get their warrior faster to the left side starting city.
Yep. Mm-hmm. The warrior positioning is a big deal in PvP. Like, if you even just read some play-by-email reports of people playing against each other, somebody's warrior wandering around in your territory can be a problem because they can pillage you. You need substantial investment of resources to get rid of that of your own units when at a time where you want to be building settlers and builders to expand. So that's pretty bad on its own, but they can pillage you and they can actually take your builder and potentially delete it if they catch you out, which would be awful. That kind of stuff can easily cost you the game if you take too much damage from that kind of harass.
In between your pillaging point and the taking your builder, they could just sit there on your hex and prevent you from ever improving that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, oh, is this your iron? Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah, if they're on a hill, like between your current cities and the cities you want to settle, and they're fortified there, yeah, good luck getting rid of that. It's going to be really difficult to dislodge that.
They'll heal as fast as you damage them.
Yeah.
Elsewise, rivers disabled. Quote, rivers provide great fresh water to cities, but unfortunately we were not able to mirror rivers properly, and as a result, some teams may receive superior land with rivers enabled, unquote.
Hmm. They can't mirror rivers.
Well, if you can't, then I guess you have to scratch them. But man, okay.
It feels a little bit like a slippery slope. Slippery slope. Rivers.
If it's a doctored map, which it kind of has to be competitive,
yeah.
Because again, the spawns are not designed to be balanced at all. So they could just toss in lakes here and there for fresh water. It'd be like, here's an oasis on this city site. Here's an oasis on that city site. You can do stuff like that.
Got a few one-tall lakes around.
Yeah.
But this pushes Egypt out of the top tier.
Oh, no.
They will no longer get their river synergy.
You can just pretend they're banned for balance.
Excluded for balance.
Functionally banned. They are functionally banned.
Functionally banned. Speaking also of balance, all unique buildings will receive the same corresponding upgrades as their standard counterpart. So, no unique buildings. Okay. Fair enough. And they also wrap the map so that players can better engage in naval warfare.
Mm.
Trading gold per turn and trading cities to teammates will equal instant disqualification.
Fair. I always hated that. And that's been a problem since at least Civ 4, maybe earlier. If you're playing in like a competitive setting and somebody is losing, they can just rage quit give their cities to someone who wasn't involved in the war. And I've seen write-ups of competitive games where players do that and somehow people are okay with it. It was like the people benefiting, not having to spend any resources. It's supposed to be a free-for-all, and someone's just getting 3+ cities for free. Like, to me, that's bannable, and someone who accepts the cities has violated a non-aggression pact. Like,
yeah.
I don't care.
It's an act of war, effectively.
Yeah, and I've seen people respecting naps with people who took cities from their war target. And I'm just like, F that noise. If someone's doing that, I'm nap stabbing them, and I thumb my nose and have expletives for anybody who considers that a nap stab. If they're going to cheese like that, I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, I mean, what they've done is they've pre-conquered your cities.
Yeah.
That was your city they took.
Pretty much. It's different if they declare and take it themselves. That's different. Okay, fine. But that's not what's going on here. So yeah, I am perfectly fine. In fact, I applaud that they've set that role, because that role needed to be there in any competitive format.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say, oh, well, no, if they go ahead and they trade the cities to teammates, then, you know, that's just, you know, just an instant declaration of war. Well, no, you need to be instantly disqualified, because it's like, hey, guess what? I've got this city, and look at that. You know, you were attacking it and stuff like that, and, you know, your units were right there. Not only we pushed you away, but, you know, we're back up to full strength and stuff. So screw you.
Yeah.
Didn't they change that? That cities no longer get full strength when they're transferred?
Given when they were playing this game.
Right.
Back in March, that would have also been an issue at that time. But yes, it's important to note that the defense thing has been addressed just in the quote-unquote general game. And, no duplicate leaders permitted on the same team. Okay.
Interesting.
You can't all be Monty.
Not this game. You can trade off on who's Monty if you want to keep playing with the same teammates from game to game.
Team full Monty.
There you go.
We are working on leader-specific balance changes, and will eventually have a select roster of leaders ideal for competitive Civ 6. Oh, I'm pretty sure people already have their roster, but anyway. We are also attempting to change the victory condition mechanics to be more in tune with esports. The goal is to create a game where all victory conditions will be viable in a 30 to 60 minute session. And I must admit, my brain went, Civilization Revolution? Wait, what? No.
Is that actually true in Civ Rev? I've never played it.
60-minute session? What?
Actually, 60 minutes actually seems long for a game in Civilization Revolution, to be honest.
Well, if you're running on online speed and you have a 100-turn cap, I can see that I can see that only taking an hour.
Yeah.
Quite possibly less if someone successfully harasses or rushes out. Or fails a rush. Either of those would end the game pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's very true. You're all in or you're all out. And then on the 27th of March, the winner was announced, Damage Incorporated, although the other top places went to Civilization Player League's representatives. Quote, even though the weekend was dominated by general stacking, quote-unquote, and connectivity issues, the experience provided us with valuable knowledge that will allow us to improve competitive gameplay at the highest level, unquote.
Everyone here knows what general stacking is, right? And by everyone, I mean our listening audience as well. So the way that works, that you basically rush out a couple of great generals as quickly as possible, probably building projects for it. It would not surprise me if they did that. Mm-hmm. If you get two generals from the same era, or maybe one from an earlier era, one from the next era, so you have overlapping. Say you have two generals, one's classical medieval, one's medieval renaissance. They will both apply their bonuses to the medieval units. So your medieval units will get plus 10 strength from great generals and plus 2 movement points per turn from great generals. So you would have, just for example, if you got this bonus on a swordsman, or you could get like a legion with 50 strength and 4 moves super early in the game, and that's before promotions. Stronger than a knight, equally fast, classical era, and without the knight's weaknesses. And obviously, cities trying to defend against this are helpless with the battering ram. But that is also capable of either one-shotting or very close to one-shotting just about any stock unit trainable in the classical era on top of that, because it's a unique unit doing it. Now, Rome was banned, but you get the idea. Stack, if you have oligarchy on this and you're stacking all these bonuses together, there's almost no counterplay to it. And even going up to a future era does not make up the difference because of the double general. And so it does not surprise me that the competition got dominated by people just rushing those out, especially because in getting those generals, you are denying them to your enemy. Mm-hmm. So your enemy does not have them, and you do. It's just an unwinnable scenario for the defender.
Hence the higher cost for great generals to come in future tournaments.
Yeah. But for now, like if you're playing somebody in the vanilla game, and you see someone investing in an encampment that you think can attack you in the near future, you'd best be getting at least a great general of your own, because not only will it deny your enemy a second great general, but it'll give you a chance to survive.
Yeah.
Some great generals are just better to pick up than others.
That's true. If you let someone double GG you, you're dead. You're not going to live that.
Yeah. If somebody pulls a bombard in the classical or medieval era, you're in trouble.
I mentioned earlier about their comment with regards to designed a spectator mode so we viewers can join in on the action. Follow up from that in the post-tournament report. Quote, our next tournament will feature a longer stream delay to help offset stream sniping.
Ah, yes.
Oh, no. Yeah, I picked up on that. Also, fun user interface pop-ups to elaborate on game features and strategies. A dedicated team of commentators and broadcasters. Woohoo! Esports-style team graphics and highlights and player profiles.
Does anybody know someone like that?
What, people who can commentate and broadcast their voice? No, I don't know anybody like that, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I guess we're out of luck there.
It's interesting to watch how much better it has gotten from the start of the StarCraft II release to now in terms of the quality of the broadcasts. It's not like they were awful at first, but they're much closer to like true professional now.
I think that also describes Polycast, Phil. Thank you. It's very nice to be
seen. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're all pros here. It's true.
I hear the giant air quotes. Cheaper wonders, lower trader costs, 3 starting trade routes instead of 1, lower building costs, increased yields from chopping forests and rainforests.
Ooh.
Victory condition diversity. Science, culture, and religious victories will become far more plausible. They said that it will become far more plausible doesn't mean that they will in fact be plausible.
Yes, science victory in 100 turns. I'll do it.
Go, go, go.
Well, on online speed, maybe. I don't know.
Well, unless they change what a science victory is, like X number of beakers a turn.
That's true. That's true. Like, if you research a certain technology before in time, then you win.
And improvements to spectator options such as full resource reveal. Well, you might want to have a really long stream delay or something. But
a 1 hour stream delay?
Well, yeah, if you do that, then the game's over. It doesn't matter. You can say whatever you want. That's interesting, though, because, like, it's harder to stream snipe in a game like StarCraft 2, where if you're on a minute delay...
My gosh.
Any information that the streamers could provide to your opponent would be...
Outdated.
Very dated.
Ugh.
Your opponent could have transitioned by then already, or you've probably already scouted that or you're dead. So I imagine that wasn't really high on their thoughts when they started doing streaming of a turn-based game where even like 10 minutes you could still potentially give somebody his full information.
Mm-hmm.
The concluding sentence from Mr. Game Theory. We wish for Axis the best of luck with bringing multiplayer Civilization to at least a somewhat respectable level of online play while we play other games than Lobby Simulator 2017. Unquote. Well, you know, if we can have Goat Simulator, we can certainly have Lobby Simulator, I tell you what.
Yeah.
Let's greenlight that right now.
Probably a little too early to try and make this an eSport.
Yeah. And more power to them if they want to mod the game to make it closer. And developers might be able to see some of that as decent. So we'll see how it goes.
I think once the DLL mods come out, then stuff like this might be more appropriate. They'll be able to do more. Tune the game more for high-speed action.
Speaking of action, we got a little bit more feedback.
Yes, and I'm intended to introduce this very well. So more episode 279 feedback. Presumably this is just the stuff following your comment, Dan, for Magma Dragoon.
Yes.
And he says, if anything, we don't gripe enough. Oh, we can accommodate. The game isn't fun, fast turn 100 without mods, production doesn't scale with cost, borders take forever to grow, units are sluggish, and game feels like a no-fun slog. It's interesting. Some people care about this a lot more than others. I'm actually in the camp that hates the controls and game speed play of Civ 6, although it still has some redeeming features. So I get where he's coming from, and I've certainly made my stance on this pretty clear on the forums, but also in Polycast to a degree. The game has terrible UI, and it does play slowly, but there's only so much you can harp on it. No matter how much we say that, it's not going to change. Like, the developers aren't going to turn around and be like, oh no, Polycast is disapproving of us more strongly than before. We'd better actually fix this now. I mean, they already posted it for a UI guy. Like,
yeah.
Yes, it's not acceptable, but how much of our time and your time do we want to spend on addressing that?
Yeah.
So
I don't know about borders take forever to grow. I don't know, get more culture.
In production, not scaling with costs, I'm okay with it, especially with the policy cards you have available and how effective money can be.
There's so many workarounds to that. I don't have a big problem with that. And you can come up with the production for Science Victory if for some weird reason you actually want to go for one. I do agree with units being sluggish, although again, I feel like a lot of that criticism comes down more so to controls than the game's design. If you had decent pathing when you're trying to path a unit across your empire in peacetime, if you weren't constantly prompted to move units with like one move left that couldn't go into a forest this turn, if you had like decent unit cycling such that you could actually enable unit cycling and it went to scene targets each time you moved a unit, roads perhaps kept units on them a little better when pathing. You add some of this type of stuff, maybe add some waypoints, and all of a sudden it's not that bad. The game doesn't have that stuff. That's why it feels so sluggish. I want to see the game with that before we start talking about the design aspects of movement and how that's a slog. Because I feel like if this game had good controls regarding its rules, it wouldn't be that bad to move units.
Yeah. Once you can play the game easier, you can test it easier.
Yeah. And like, I would hate to see design accommodate terrible UI. Like, I'd rather see the UI be good and then the design work off of the good UI.
Well, I would hope that the design had nothing to do with the UI.
Yeah, well,
Game mechanic design and stuff like that had nothing to do with the UI, except for going, okay, well, game design wise, we need to give you more information here or here or here.
How would a DLC leader who has the ability to give you alternate graphics for different promotions on units?
No, that sounds like a basis for microtransactions.
Yeah.
As if anyone really needs a basis for that these days.
Yuck.
So yeah, it needs work and we all know it, but harping on it too much is not going to make the show better.
Please donate to our Patreon so we can help keep improving our alpha.
There was an email from Kristen.
Hey guys, can you do an episode on which Civs in playstyle would be best for each play scheme? He's loved the show. He's listened to all the Civ 4 episodes. He bought it about a year ago. He's on Civ 6 now, so I guess he just skipped 5. If he only just got into Civ, that kind of makes sense. Although it's probably a heck of an adjustment to go from Civ 4 and then suddenly hexes.
No, I think 4 to 6 is easier than 4 to 5 because there are a lot more of the thinking of 4 translates to 6 than 5.
A bit.
Tristan, when you say that you bought Civilization 4 just a year ago, did you play any previous Civilization titles? Or did you maybe play Civilization 5 before you bought Civ 4? Like, was this your first foray into Civ?
Civs and playstyles for each play speed. I'd say if you have ancient era stuff, unique units like Gilgamesh or Aztecs, then you want to be on online speed.
No, Marathon. Oh,
Marathon. Yeah, because the
Unmarathon can just rush everything out, win the game right then.
No, you want to go online speed because then you can produce your unique units in a reasonable time frame versus standard speed.
Yep.
I strongly disagree with this. You can win the game outright with war cards on Marathon. Yes, it takes a while to build them, but it takes everybody so long to get out of the dumpsters of the ancient era that you can conquer everybody at once before you run out of time.
Game speed is basically deciding on what do you think the ratio should be between unit movement and production. That's all it is.
Yeah, in general. Or how long do you feel like playing this game?
How fast
do you want your stuff to become outdated?
Yeah, and on the slower speeds, early units are game-winning units.
I would any difficulty to never become outdated.
Yeah, but it's kind of a thing. Yeah, I mean, normally, the earlier your unique unit is, the longer you want to be able to play in that era. But that's part of the game design, too. That's a functional problem with the game design since Civ 1. Because if you have to think about it, the ancient and classical era, effectively, in real life, was two-thirds of the time spent from 4000 BC to now. Except that you spend in-game maybe 20% of the game, if you're lucky, in that era. In that section. So it's kind of like all those civs that we pick, it's like, oh, they had these big empires and blah, blah, blah. And that was all before 0 AD. And they had, in real life, a crap ton of time that you just can't do that in the game. The time scale just does not suit that.
Unless you make it so slow that every era has tons of time. But man, that can be a drag.
Yeah.
Well, or speed up the end game.
Yeah.
Just blitz through the end game text.
You know what, though? There is a problem in Civ that's not unique to Civ, but really any 4X, where you have the game ending before it actually has a victor declared pretty often. So yeah. You can make a case for having some of these things accelerate towards the end, just so that you don't have like 50 turns of, hey, we know who won this game already, but we have to hit end turn 50 more times to make it official.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember in Civilization 2, you launch your spaceship, and then you got to wait some turns.
That was still true in Civ 4.
Oh, right.
Although Civ 4 gave you the chance in the expansion to take a capital, which would cause the ship launch to fail and be destroyed. So they actually added a purpose to making you wait, and that you had to defend your capital for those turns, or you would lose your space progress. And if somebody took and raises your capital, you're probably not going to win the game either. So,
yeah.
I think the basis was, okay, you're going to some far-off star system, but your life on this planet's been over. So by the time they come to contact back, it'll be Greek.
And they'll probably be infected with fungus or something.
Yeah.
So the constant end turn is about waiting for death?
Yeah, pretty much. Letting somebody else decide to nuke you out of existence.
I mean, you could launch a ship and nuke them out of existence at the same time.
Yeah. Like, screw you people, we're out of here. We're going to make a mess of this place before we go.
Tristan, I hope you're satisfied with us just answering this as part of a segment, not an entire episode. Either way, thanks for listening to the show. And writing in, too. It's nice to know that you exist.
And that we're not just shouting into the void.
Well, we do that anyway, but...
I was.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
So this has been Polycast episode 281. I've been host Madjin, joined by Makalua.
Oh, the son of Captain of the World some days.
The mean team.
Tactically inserting Red Dog Raiders into your coast.
Thank you.
Join a secret society.
And we've been joined by our guest, Hans.
I think everyone should just live in peace as one happy family.
That's boring.
Well, pieces can count, right? Peace is, right? That's okay.
Wait, whose family?
Rest in pieces and pieces.
And how do you define family? Although, you know, Hans, I think you should buy a lottery ticket and use the number 171, because that's how many episodes it's been since you were last on the show.
Wow.
Congratulations on being the guest with the second longest time running in between appearances. How does this make you feel?
Second longest. I remember it was like right after Civ 5 had come out, and I remember one thing from that polycast. We were talking about the El Dorado thingy, Mabob. Or if you
found Dorado.
Skill Dorado. Skill Dorado.
Yeah. Wait a minute. You remembered that you were on the episode about El Dorado, but you didn't remember Skill Dorado? Mackie had to prompt you?
No. I remembered it was Skill Dorado. I was just not providing the proper context, because it's not necessarily obvious that Skill Dorado is a reference to El Dorado. So I had,
yes,
to lead. Oh. You think E for England comes after egg,
yeah,
for Egypt?
Uh-huh.
Yes, we do.
EN comes after EG.
Wow. You know, this is why this podcast is so educational. I am learning how to read and spell, and someday I'm going to be the smartest guy ever.
I thought you were going to say, and someday I'm going to learn how to talk, but, you know.
Yeah, that's my job, learning how to say things right.
So are you saying the secret is to be an Imperial Empire yourself?
This show is educational. Wow, you're right.
That's the secret.
But speaking of the conquest, the Red Dog unique naval raider unit, which you can use to escort your redcoats.
The Red Dog? The Red Dog escorts your sea coats? What?
Did I say that? The Sea Dog
escorts... You see Clifford emerge from the shores,
yes,
and, like, stomp the city down.
big red dog. Go squish.
Yes, the sea dog escorting your red coats. There we go.
The red dogs and sea coats. Yes.
Well, you know, you got to be brave in the elements, so you do want a sea coat. You don't just want any kind of coat.
Mm. True. You put it on, you resist the water element, and take reduced damage from cannon fire.
Record date May 13th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.